Thank you very much, Paul. And thank all of you for being here, for your interest, and for your curiosity. I'm not here to make a speech, as I hope has been made clear. I would like to say a few things at the outset. First of all, welcome back home, Pat. Last time I was here, Pat was on his way on foreign journeys. I hope that his journeys have been as productive as mine have been. I'm here to answer questions and to get down to the nitty-gritty of what is on your mind. Not that I'm suggesting there's nitty-gritty on your mind in any direct material sense, but I know you have questions or you wouldn't be here. I hope you have some curiosity as to who I am and what I represent, and that you may be satisfied to some extent on that score before this afternoon is over. As I contemplate the almost endless round of audiences and people I'm asked to speak to and produce for, I'm often reminded of what Judge Strunk, a very celebrated Maine comedian, whom I think you are getting to know out here in California, once described as the shortest will in the history of Maine. It was just 10 words, which constitutes a pretty good Maine speech most of the time. And the 10 words were these: being of sound mind and body, I spent it all. And I sometimes feel that I've spent it all when I think of the next exertion of energy that I am called upon to make. What I am about, of course, is the possibility of seeking the top leadership of this country next year. And you know that, and I know that. In due course, I'll make a decision that I don't think is very doubtful at this point. But in the process of making that decision, it's important that I examine and that you examine who I am, what I am, what I believe, what I think about for the future. And so I would hope now, in not more than a few seconds, you would begin to direct questions to me, as straight questions and as direct questions and as testing questions as you may like. I won't promise to answer them all to your satisfaction. I'll try to answer them to my satisfaction.
Senator, the administration's foreign aid bill was before the Senate last week. Would you clarify for us your position on this foreign aid bill?
I would have voted for final passage of the bill, and yet I don't regard the Senate's action as irresponsible or as a disaster. I regard it as an opportunity to begin the process of reshaping our foreign assistance programs, because I think unless we do reshape them and redirect them, that we are likely to lose whatever support remains for that kind of a national effort. I think the vote last week was not so much a reaction to the developments at the United Nations that suggested from time to time, as it was a culmination of frustrations that had been mounting over a number of years. And I can suggest some of them. One of them, of course, revolves around military assistance. That bill involved about 55% to 60% of military assistance. And I think following the revelations as to how our military assistance has been used in places like Pakistan and India, Greece, Brazil, and other countries, not to overlook Southeast Asia, there is a growing disillusionment about the program of military assistance, and I think that disillusionment has undermined support for the economic and humanitarian aid programs, which I think are of concern to you here in this room. with respect to economic assistance. Our programs have been less effective than they should have been. Phase one, and this is to use the new terminology, phase one of foreign assistance, of course, was the Marshall Plan, and it worked in Europe. But we never succeeded in modifying the program to bring it to bear with precise focus upon the problems of developing countries. And even here, economic assistance has tended to, increasingly in recent years, to emphasize supporting assistance, so-called. That is, as a part or as a complement to military assistance in countries like South Vietnam and other countries that we could mention around the world where it is intended to serve our strategic interests rather than the economic and humanitarian interests of the countries involved. I think that there is a case for economic assistance and humanitarian assistance that rests in the conscience of the American people. But for a quarter of a century, we've been justifying aid in terms of American strategic interests. We sold it in the first place as an instrument in the Cold War. We sold it as a way of using foreign bodies instead of American bodies on the front lines of the Cold War confrontation. And that was a persuasive argument for the American people for all of the early years of the aid program. But I think it was a disservice to the long-range objectives of the aid program. I don't think the American people need to be deluded by their own fears into supporting the legitimate aspirations of the developing nations of the earth. And that's what I think what we now have to do, if we're really to do what I think our conscience tells us we must do to help developing countries to improve their own circumstances and the lives of their own people. And so we have a new series of foreign aid bills in the Senate, two. The effort was made to make it three, an economic assistance bill, a humanitarian aid bill, and a military assistance program, which of course would include aid to Israel, which is of interest to many in this room. And I think that that's the way it ought to be, and that each of these programs ought to rest on its own legs. And I think that if we make the case on the merits, the American people will support it.
About the House bill that evidently is going to slow down busing as one way of fighting the immigration problem. And second, and perhaps more importantly here in Los Angeles especially, what can the federal government do, if anything, to help us where we now have earthquake-damaged schools, no money for them? Across the country, there are other school districts who are already closed down. Does the federal government have a role that it can increasingly play in education in this aspect, let alone the whole integration question?
Well, with respect to the House action, I deplore that action. I would not support it in the Senate. I understand how emotional an issue busing is. My view of it is this, that busing does not get at the fundamental inequity or injustice, and it can't by itself correct the conditions that lead to segregation in the schools and a deprivation from quality education of blacks and other minorities. But nevertheless, it is a tool that can be useful, in many cases maybe the only one, and we should be willing to use it. I think we have to go beyond that to get at the fundamental conditions which have been structured into our society and our housing patterns, into the political fragmentation of local government and metropolitan areas, employment patterns, transportation patterns, the development of the suburbs. These are the institutions that are responsible for segregation and indeed reflect the urge towards segregation in the past. And to change those conditions, is something that isn't going to be comfortable. There's no easy way to break away from the barriers that separate different groups in our society. It's going to be uncomfortable. And so busing is uncomfortable. And basically what underlines the resistance to it is fear. because so many Americans view the racial question as a confrontation leading to potential violence, and they look upon busing as a requirement that their children, you know, take their places in the front ranks on the cutting edge of that potential violence. So it's fear that underlines, I think, the resistance to busing. And I think the only answer to it is to do our best, and I think it's a responsibility of leadership to help in this regard, to do our best to get Americans to look at the reality of what it is that we're dealing with. And I think that through the right kind of leadership and the right kind of educational efforts, we can move the American people in the direction of justice. Now, with respect to the overall question of federal aid for education, I've seen it, of course. I've seen federal support for education move from zero when I first went to the Senate 13 years ago to a multi-billion dollar program today. And it will continue to grow. As a matter of fact, the programs that the Congress has authorized haven't been fully funded. And if they were, federal aid for education would be massively greater than it now is. Now, I don't know of any initiative up to now directed toward the particular problem of earthquake-damaged schools. That hasn't been brought to my attention, nor has it been the subject of any initiative in the Congress, to the best of my information. But federal support of public education, I think, is going to have to increase. And we're going to have to increasingly apply federal resources to the social problems of our cities. I mean, revenue sharing is one such manifestation of the need. And principally, the reason is, or the two basic reasons for it. One, that political fragmentation, especially in metropolitan areas, has separated, you know, the resources of our country from the people needs of our country. To put it even more simply, the suburbs and the central cities are separated, and the only way to mobilize the resources to deal with the problems is, well, revenue sharing is one way to do it. Yes, sir. Question is, what is the efficacy? Did you all hear it? Do I have to repeat questions? All right, I'll repeat it then. The question is, what is my view of the efficacy of phase two of the president's economic policy? Well, in the first place, phase two is just a structure and not a policy. We don't know what the policy will be. The policies are emerging as the various boards and commissions apply themselves to the president's, to the responsibility the president imposed on them. We don't yet have a price-setting policy. We don't yet have a wage-setting policy. And until we see those policies, it's hard to evaluate them. I think that the president has created a very difficult task for himself in beginning with phase one, because phase one was a total, across-the-board, arbitrary, hard-line prohibition against any increases in wages or prices. And to move from that harsh kind of prohibition into a more flexible one gives the appearance of backing off. And in the process of backing off, you have to be concerned with the question of even-handedness. Because if the American people get the idea that the policies aren't even-handed, they will not support them. The question of nevertheless adjusting to the inequities that were frozen into place by the wage price freeze of the first phase, inequities that were developed out of the president's first three economic policies in the first 2.5 years of his administration, without the flexibility to deal with those, the program will tend to lose public support. So the program isn't a policy yet, it's a structure, and until we see the policies, we can't evaluate. Question is my opinion of Mr. Rehnquist and how I will vote on it. Number one, I know only that he has on his record and a good mind, apparently a good legal mind, an excellent law school record, but I know nothing or not enough about his judicial philosophy to evaluate it, and will not make a decision on his qualifications for the court until the record is complete. On the basis of his intellectual attainments and his capacity, he's worthy of consideration. Whether I can support him on the basis of judicial philosophy, I will decide when the record is complete. And on that point, may I say that recent court appointed the record of hearings on recent court appointees suggests that one ought not to be precipitate in making final judgment. Yes, sir.
Senator, 10 years ago, you talked about orderly marketing and warned that we would export thousands of jobs and lose jobs if we didn't have it. Now, 10 years later, we've lost hundreds of thousands of jobs. It's apparent that this present law or this 10% surcharge is not the answer. Don't you think this is the time to press for orderly marketing is the only way to get our jobs back?
Well, I think we need a mechanism, and I think it ought to be an international mechanism to deal with the adjustment problems related to the impact of import competition, for the very simple reason that what seems to make the difference now between our being competitive not only abroad but in our own markets is the disparity in wage levels between our own country and competing countries. We've always treated that aspect of foreign trade as a unilateral problem to be dealt with by countries in accordance with their own internal domestic pressures. And the result is that there's a wide pattern across the whole trading world of protections that have been erected by the great trading nations like Japan and others. And I think unless we come to see this as an international problem and deal with it effectively, that what we will spark is a wave of protectionism that would be, I think, against our country's best interests and against the best interests of stability in international economic and monetary and trade affairs. And this is the reason I introduced orderly marketing 11 years ago, not as a protectionist device, but as a way of triggering concern about this problem.
Senator, we hear you criticized as not leading and taking safe positions. How can we answer that criticism?
Well, it isn't true. You know, how do I prove the negative of a question? The question is, we hear you criticized for not leading and taking safe positions. How do you prove the negative of that? You know, I could take the position, well, everything I've said in the last 3 years is either on paper or on tape. And you can judge for yourself by examining the record. It isn't true. I understand the criticism, and I read it, and I can be frustrated by it. But the fact is that you can't have conducted the kind of travel around the country that I have for 3 years, facing 70 to 80 college audiences, press conferences several times a day for weeks on end, and evade the tough questions. Now, I don't know what else I can say to that. You can ask the tough questions here today and see if I dodge them, or anywhere else. And believe me, nobody throws, soft snowballs at me as I travel around the country. And so I try to answer them, and I try to take positions. I try to take direct positions. I try to be honest with people. Occasionally, one such answer gets visibility, and I'm criticized then for having been honest and direct. I gave an answer here in Los Angeles not so long ago with respect to the viability of a national ticket with a black on it, and I don't think you'd interpret that as a safe position, and I'd be glad to go into that. But the point is, of course, that sometimes, whether a man is direct or honest or responsive to tough questions or tough issues has to do with the public's perception of the way in which he answers a question. And I don't pound the table most of the time. I can on occasion, as my wife very well knows. But I don't always. And sometimes the fact that I'm low-key in my response conceals what I think is a direct answer. But perhaps the best answer to your question is whatever tough questions come up this afternoon. If that doesn't satisfy you, we'll try to go beyond that.
Mr. Senator, in addition to revenue sharing, what would you do about what appears to be the terrible plight of the big cities, the racial hatreds, the unemployment, the welfare, the morass in which we appear to be caught?
Well, of course, with respect to all of our domestic problems, and I think the one you've mentioned is perhaps the most challenging and difficult, you have two aspects to the question. One, attitudes are involved. And two, programs are involved. Now, with respect to programs, of course, you'll get a wide range of proposals in the next year from all of the candidates and potential candidates about what you do with the problems of the cities. And all of us have records indicating our concern one way or another and our capacity for developing answers and solutions and imaginative proposals. And I have a record that I'm not ashamed of in this connection, and we'll propose others as we go along. But basically, we're not really going to come to grips with the problems of the cities unless we change our attitudes about each other. Because no matter what proposal we deal with, we get a negative reaction in America today. Let's take revenue sharing. Now, revenue sharing is not the best answer to the problem to which it is addressed. The problem to which it is addressed is the fact that in metropolitan America, there is no effective government today for the very simple reason that local government at the metropolitan level is fragmented. In the Chicago area, there are over 1,000 units of local government. In the Chicago metropolitan area, there is no metropolitan area-wide government. In New York City, there's a similar situation, and so on across the board. Now, it's impossible in that kind of a situation to mobilize the resources of those areas so that they can be more effectively and efficiently applied to the people problems of the whole area. Those people who live in the affluent jurisdictions undertake in the present climate of opinion in this country to protect themselves and to create barriers between themselves and those areas in the metropolitan area which have the problems. And so revenue sharing is a way of moving resources from suburbs to central cities. That's it, basically. Now, it is a way, but I doubt that in and of itself it's going to do the job. Now, you can also make that transfer through particular programs, like aid to education, or like welfare reform, and so on down the road. And there are a number of those, and we have to address ourselves to them and improve them. And so I'm all for welfare reform. I support the president's initiative. I think that his proposal needs to be improved, strengthened, and refined. But the initiative was needed. And I think if we take it and follow through on it, we'll do three things of great importance. One, we'll take a tremendous load, tax load, off the backs of states and cities which still have welfare in their budgets. Secondly, we can establish, or at least move in the direction of establishing, uniform national standards, which will have the effect of, thirdly, of providing more humane levels of assistance to those who need assistance, and in addition, hopefully restrain and inhibit the movement of people in this country which is related to the quality of public services, and especially welfare services, in this country. And we've got to get at those three problems. Now, if you get into the whole wide range of metropolitan problems, you have to go far beyond what I suggested in this brief answer. Now, some of the things that I've been connected with, I was reminded of in Newark a couple of weeks ago when I was there. Now, Newark is a case, and I'm going to take just a few moments to dwell on it, of what happens when government in our cities comes close to breaking down. Newark is a city, for example, where the property tax has reached really confiscatory levels. For example, a house that sells for $10,000 on today's market in Newark pays a property tax in excess of $900 a year. That means that that house consumes its own value in taxes in something like 11 years. And the consequence, of course, is predictable. You can drive through the streets of Newark and find building after building just abandoned. The owners walk away from it. They don't want to own it. They don't want the responsibility for it. And so you see urban decay setting in and destroying the city. In Newark, 40% of the land area, Newark hasn't got that much, is tax exempt. A large part of it, for example, owned and occupied New York Port Authority, which operates the airport. Now, the only taxes that come to the city of Newark from that 40% of its land area is $1 million a year from the Port Authority, and that is fixed by a 100-year contract for the next 99 years. So Newark must get its taxes from the remaining 60% of its land area. There isn't a doctor in the central city of Newark. They've all fled to the suburbs. So now the mayor is confronted with the challenge of providing medical clinics somehow in the city to provide health care for the poor, the deprived, and the disadvantaged in the central city. Now, this is the kind of deterioration in public services, property values, the climate of the city that can take place unless we come to grips with these city problems. Now, I visited with the mayor some areas of rehabilitation housing that he's undertaken, and they're good. Now, these were produced under three programs for which I was more responsible than any other senator: model cities, rent supplements, and uniform relocation assistance, to be of assistance to people who are displaced by action of any level of government. Now, here are three specific programs that are of use, but they're only, you know, a beginning. And so we must move on from those kinds of experimental initiatives into more broadly based, broadly hitting programs to deal with the problems of the cities. I don't know that anyone in America at this moment has that kind of a program on blueprints. I doubt it. But I think that the first step, you know, is to expose the problem in such stark terms as this Newark one. And I think when you do, you can get the necessary public support to do what needs to be done.
Wilbur Mills, talking to the Los Angeles Area Chamber of Commerce last week about the fiscal situation this country's in, where nobody seems to even know what's going on, suggested congressional control of spending as a solution to the problem that we have today. Would you support such a program, Senator?
Well, I don't know what Mr. Mills proposed by way of congressional control, whether he was advocating, what he was advocating with respect to the kinds of programs we're talking about here today.
This program, now, as I understand it, would be that no federal agency would be permitted to spend more than a certain sum of money, irrespective of appropriations, and this business of issuing papers between federal agencies would have to come to an end, as I understand the program.
Well, that doesn't give me many specifics. I mean, if what he's talking about is, you know, an elimination of the federal deficit overnight, and that's on the order of $23 billion last year, the fiscal year ending July 1st, I know where the impact would fall. The impact would fall upon the shoulders of those people least able to carry the burden of dealing with our economic problem in this country. You're going to have to cut all the people problems. The assistance for the poor, the assistance for public education, the federal programs which have some effect of lifting the burden off property taxpayers. I mean, these public services that are involved are going to be met. There's a cost involved in these social programs. If the programs don't exist, the cost is human misery and deprivation and discontent. If some level of government other than the federal government has to bear the cost, then it's the overburdened property tax at the local level or strained state budgets at the state level. Now, the federal revenue system is the only system available to us to really tap the resources of this country where they exist to apply to these problems. Now, federal deficits have to be analyzed differently than the deficits of other levels of government. The federal budget serves two functions. The first function is to support public services. The second function is to stimulate or control the economy. It has to be used for both purposes. Now, President Kennedy demonstrated how tax cuts at a time of federal deficits are a good thing. By doing that, in 1965, he revived the economy increased federal revenues and put us well on the road until the Vietnam War hit us, toward a stable federal budget and a growing economy. So that looking at the federal budget only from the point of view of a support for public services is not a broad enough perspective on the federal budget. Now, my own view of where we need to apply fiscal medicine at the present time, or economic medicine at the present time, is at the level of consumer spending and consumer consumption. That's where the economy is soft. Now, the president has proposed stimuli for business in order to encourage investment in new plant. Well, we are now, of course, operating under capacity. We can produce a third more than we are with the present industrial plant. So that isn't the soft spot. And I find very little encouragement for the idea that there will be new plant constructed that will create new jobs as a result of this investment tax credit the president's proposing at the present time, or the accelerated depreciation costing some $4 billion in federal revenues that the president implemented administratively in January of this year. Neither one of those, it seems to me, is going to get at the soft spot in our economy. So I think we need to direct the stimulus at consumer buying. Consumer confidence is what we need to stimulate buying. Consumer savings right now, with all, you know, with a depressed economy, with unemployment, and with inflation, consumer savings are a third higher than they've been for a long time, indicating a lack of consumer confidence. Not that I'm against savings, but when you have savings in this kind of a situation, what you have is a retreat from the marketplace, a reduction in sales, a reduction in production, a reduction in employment. And the president's economic policy doesn't address itself to that problem. Well, don't you wish sometime that somebody had cried wolf when the internal combustion engine was invented? You know, the idea that you can try an environmentally dangerous thing, and if, you know, unhappy consequences don't immediately flow, that thus it was right, is an argument I don't buy, because it's that very callous attitude toward technological development and growth that has brought us to the present environmental crisis that we face in this country. I mean, we got away with it once, so we do it again, and then we do it again. That's the point, but there are some other implications of that blast that we have to bear in mind also. You know, we get caught up in momentum in this whole area of public policy that carries us on ultimately to unfortunate consequences. I mean, there's the arms control implications of the blast at Amchitka. We are trying, in the SALT talks, to stabilize the nuclear arms race. That's the stated objective. And we're given by the administration and by such information as we can get indirectly and directly that there are the prospects for an agreement, and particularly an agreement on an ABM. And so, if the prospects are real, and I'm ready to accept the proposition that they are, then in due course there will be an agreement defining the shape of the ABM system, or the anti-ballistic missile defense system, that each of the two countries will be permitted under the agreement. Well, why then are we in the process now of testing components of an ABM system before the mission that will be permitted has been defined? All we do by proceeding with the testing of new technology intended to implement an ABM system is to escalate the arms race at the very time when we're trying to stabilize it. Now, that doesn't make any sense. Secondly, in the limited test ban treaty, then subsequently in the comprehensive test ban treaty, we made a commitment to the non-nuclear nations that with the Soviet Union, we would do everything we could to press for a total test ban. A total test ban treaty, so there'd be no need for any underground testing. Well, it seems to me that the best evidence we could have given the world, including non-nuclear nations, of our commitment to that objective is not to test a weapon of this magnitude at this stage of negotiations with the Soviet Union over a limitation of nuclear arms. Do you realize? In terms of the environmental danger, do you understand fully the size, the magnitude of the blast that took place? That nuclear device was 250 times the size of the bomb that destroyed Hiroshima. And it was exploded in an area that's earthquake prone. Now, do you have to prove, you know, beyond any question and with certainty that that won't trigger unfortunate environmental results before you stop? I mean, that's like saying that it's perfectly permissible to take a high-speed automobile and race down Wilshire Boulevard at 150 miles an hour if, when it's all over, nobody's been hit, no damage has been done, pedestrians have escaped, and the driver wasn't detected by any policeman. I supported it. I regretted the fact that that Taiwan was expelled from the United Nations, because I believe in the spirit of, or in the principle of universality as the basis for UN membership. And indeed, it was the principle of universality that finally convinced me that we should give mainland China membership in the United Nations. And so I thought that on the basis of the very argument that was advanced to give membership to mainland China, Taiwan should have retained membership. The thing that I didn't like about it, other than the question of principle involved, is that I don't think it's a sound thing, looking to the future of the United Nations, to set the precedent of expelling a nation by majority vote from the United Nations. We all see how easily emotions can be inflamed in almost any legislative body or quasi-legislative body, and in any such period, almost any nation, I suppose including ourselves, might be expelled by a majority vote. We didn't have a majority vote, I might point out, last week.
Senator, how would you inspire the economic confidence going to turn the savings into consumption?
I have proposed, the question is, what steps would I suggest to stimulate consumer confidence? Well, of course, it's difficult to try to correct Mr. Nixon's mistakes. But I have advocated, for example, and I did this in Los Angeles on Labor Day. I advocated, in lieu of an investment tax credit, a consumer tax credit. Designed to give consumers a credit against taxes up to $100 for the purchase of consumer durable goods. At the lower end of the income scale, that would be a flat $100 tax credit, so that those at the lower end of the scale could use their savings for other consumer purchases than durable goods. This idea came, interestingly enough, from some businessmen in New York, who felt that this would have more relevance to the problem of the economy than the investment tax credit, and they urged me very strongly to propose it. And it has had a remarkable reception across the country, but it hasn't had the visibility to stimulate broad-based support. But it's that kind of thing, and you can, of course, shape the income tax cuts to the same end. For instance, I think that we might well suspend the Social Security tax increases that are scheduled under pending legislation for next year. An irony of that is this, that if we were to give the American taxpayer the benefit of the income tax cuts that the president proposed, but went forward with those Social Security tax increases, he would net be worse off in terms of payment of taxes to the federal government than he is now. So the regressive nature of the Social Security tax increase would offset the stimulative effect of the income tax cut now. And I think we ought to take both of those into consideration in framing the tax cut program of this year. Let's see, I'm trying to get to people who've had their hands up a while.
Senator Muskie, 25 years ago, President Truman electrified mankind with his famous Point Four program for the less developed nations. Today, after a bitter Vietnam War, we see the American people turning inward and utterly nationalistic. Do you have a program that will restore America's prestige abroad that is so badly battered?
Well, it's pretty difficult for a candidate, a potential candidate, I almost slipped, for president, to say anything as electrifying as a president in office said on this subject. I've already discussed my views of the foreign aid program and won't repeat those. I happen to believe that and here I get off into what I'm always accused of getting off on, generalities. But I can't get away from it because what is involved, you know, is the question of touching the basic sense of decency and the will to build a better country in a world that I think motivates most Americans even today. I think it exists. Now, whether or not I have the capacity or any other potential candidate for the presidency has the capacity to touch that strain in the American people is a judgment that you and other American voters are going to have to make. I mean, I can't make it. It's a self-serving judgment, but I think it's very critical. It's very critical. And what's involved, it seems to me, in now getting away from personalities, and to use a phrase that was used with me this afternoon by a friend here in Los Angeles with whom we were discussing this problem generally, is that we must restore credibility to the presidency. The presidency, when it is credible to the American people, when it has the capacity to inspire the American people, you know, can assume such leadership initiatives as President Truman did and mobilize the people behind him. We've seen it done by other leaders. We saw it done by Roosevelt in the 30s. We saw it done by Kennedy in the early 60s, and unfortunately he didn't live to give us the full measure of his potential. We saw Churchill do it. It's done by other leaders in our country's history and others. And we need that kind of credibility in the presidency to do these kinds of things. No private citizen, you know, has that capacity for electrifying the world. Oh, some of them did. Bobby Kennedy did, because he had the mystique of the Kennedy tradition behind him when he traveled abroad in Latin America and South Africa, and he had that capacity for electrifying the hopes. That's really what it amounts to, the hopes of disadvantaged people around the globe. And the presidency ought to have that capacity. And I would hope, in evaluating the potential of candidates next year, that you take that into account. I certainly will, because I think it's important. And I know it's presumptuous of me to talk about it in connection with myself, but nevertheless, it's a test I have to try to apply to myself as well as to others.
Senator, what is your opinion regarding the administration's policy towards the state of Israel? The on and off policy.
Yes, all right. The question is, what is my view of the administration's present position with respect to Israel? In order to eliminate what might seem the harshness from the answer I'm about to give, let me say this as a beginning. I thought that last January, when I was in Israel and in Egypt and in Moscow, I thought the administration was on the right track, basically, and undertook to support its position in Cairo and in Moscow and back home. I think that in recent weeks, the effect of initiatives taken by the administration has been to weaken the negotiating position of Israel with respect to her border requirements. I'm sure that wasn't the intention, but I suspect it was the effect, because it took the pressure off Egypt to move beyond what President Sadat had said to Secretary Rogers, and left the whole pressure upon Israel to respond, not only under Sadat's initiative, but under our pressure. I thought that was a mistake. I understand why we did it, and it wasn't done for the purpose of undermining Israel. As far as I know, the administration is committed, and in due course we'll probably take additional steps to strengthen Israel's military and perhaps economic viability. But I thought that that was the effect of its steps in the last few weeks and months. I think that we need to be concerned about Israel's military viability, and I've supported the proposition that we should give her the Phantom jet she requires. I think that she's going to need economic assistance from us. She has tremendous budgetary strains. The present time, you probably noted the other day, the necessity for cutting back her military budget because of the strain on her revenues. And we've got to help maintain her viability economically and military in order to support her negotiating position. And I say her negotiating position because I just don't happen to believe that we can solve the territorial and border questions involved for the parties. I think unless they somehow find a way to settle those questions between themselves, that we will not have the basis for future stability, let alone peace in the area. Martin. Well, I think perhaps the shortest answer would be to quote Mayor Lindsay himself. He has given me credit for being what he has described the most effective spokesman for the cities in the Senate of the United States. That's not bad testimony. But purely out of accident, I'll just take 2 or 3 minutes to give this since it's been asked. I happen to have been, from the day I entered the Senate, on 3 committees whose jurisdiction and responsibilities relate to urban problems. One, of course, is the Bank and Currency Committee and the Housing Subcommittee of the Bank and Currency Committee, out of which we produced the Model Cities Program and others. Secondly has been the Public Works Committee and the Subcommittee on Air and Water Pollution, out of which we produced all of the important environmental legislation of the last decade, including the water pollution amendments of last week, which in my judgment are the toughest program for water pollution control ever enacted by a legislative body on this planet. And thirdly, I was assigned to the Government Operations Committee and am chairman of the Intergovernmental Relations Subcommittee, out of which we produced the Uniform Relocation Assistance Act, which for the first time upgraded our assistance for those displaced by urban renewal, highway construction, public buildings, and so on, so that we could help them in a meaningful way to get resettled, rehoused, and compensated for the costs of moving. And also, we incorporated other provisions in that act which make it a landmark piece of legislation. So wholly out by accident, I was thrown into this area of urban concerns, have conducted hearings all over this country in connection with all 3 subcommittees, and I doubt that there's a senator who's had this accidental or deliberate opportunity to get involved in the problems of cities that I have.
Senator, we have been talking about all kinds of ways of solving problems at the federal level, and they're going to take a lot of money. Do you anticipate that the deficit spending is going to have to increase more and more in order to pay for all these?
No, I don't. I think that a growing American economy, that's of course a high priority item at the present time, can support the kinds of investments we're talking about. May I say, incidentally, the kinds of investments we're talking about must come not only from from government, but from the private sector as well. And we've got to find ways to stimulate private investment in these areas. You can't do it wholly. For instance, the Water Pollution Act of this week is going to require tremendous investment in the private sector if it's to work. It isn't just a governmental responsibility. And so if we stimulate the economy, which, you know, on the performance of the best years of the last decade indicates its capacity for growth to support these revenues, I mean, we can do this job. Now, we have to, I think, an important part of all that we do is a reordering of the priorities that are reflected in the federal budget. And that's a process that we've got to get underway with, you know, with considerable vigor.
Senator, I think we have time for one more question.
Senator, Cheryl.
Senator, in 1968, a candidate said in his inauguration speech, or the president said in his inauguration speech, that he would bring us together. Obviously, the divisiveness still remains. How, if you were successful and became president, would you bring us together?
Well, that's...
See, we shouldn't have had the last question.
You know, to answer that is such a self-serving exercise, in my judgment. But I think maybe I can answer it best by describing what I believe to be the strongest urge that I sense in Americans of all descriptions. They want to believe, once again, in each other, in their institutions, in their government, in their leaders. They want it so desperately that one can almost feel it when the subject comes up. And it's reflected in almost every question here this afternoon and in questions I get across the country. I think Americans understand that there are not automatic answers out of any political system, even the American system at its best. They understand also that leaders usually have a choice of alternatives among approaches to problems. So they understand that there's no single option or alternative or program at any given time that is necessarily the answer. And they understand finally that in order to make policy work, it has to rest upon a broad base of public support and confidence. And they understand all this. Now, you can't program an approach to bringing people together. You can't write a piece of legislation and create it. It's all bound up in the reaction to the people who are elected to public office, their record, their credibility, their integrity, their character. More than that, it's related to the directness with which they are able to speak to people. People want to know the truth about themselves, about our problems, about our country, about its potential, about its mistakes, about its failures. They want to know the truth. And it's not easy to speak the truth from the platform I occupy most of the time, because the tradition, you know, is one of expediency or maneuvering or playing a game. And it's easy to slip into that. I know all the graceful answers. You know, when somebody asks me, you know, could a black be elected on a national ticket? I know all the graceful answers. You know, I've been in politics 25 years, and I really, as I have seen the efforts made by other potential candidates to answer that question, I could do better than most of them have in answering that question. But that is not the point. I mean, we've got to make it, you know, we've got to make minorities, including blacks and Mexican Americans and others, believe in their gut that what we want is to expand the opportunity for political equality to the point where they and anyone else can seek any office in this country. We've got to make them believe that. Now, we can't make them believe that if we fool them at this end of the line. Not in my judgment. I've been at the cutting edge of expanding political equality in this country all my life. You know, I'm the first Polish American ever elected governor of any state in this country. The first Catholic ever elected governor of my state. The first Catholic ever elected a senator from my state. First Polish American ever candidate for vice president. And incidentally, we haven't proved that, you know, a Polish American could get elected vice president. And I like the feel of a country that expands political equality. I've liked it. It's made my life meaningful. And I'd like to do the same for others. And so people have got to believe in the basic ideals and objectives of our country. I think if there's one word that describes what Americans would like their country to represent, it's the word hope. It's hope that brought, I think, the forebears of everyone in this room to this country. It's hope that brought my father here. It is hope that has given America its prestige and influence around the world during its best years. The fact that we represent hope, even if only to our own people, has made us a decent country in the eyes of humanity. And that's what Americans want America to represent once again. You can do it with words in part, but words are meaningless unless you back them up with credible initiatives, you know, specific programs, and especially those that take courage, those that take effort, those that carry risks. You know, Americans like it when they're taking risks for the right purposes and for the right reasons, because Americans like to feel that they're stretching the limits of possibility for the human spirit. They like it when they're doing that. I mean, I suppose it's the frontier ethic that still motivates us. But Americans like it, and they want to be led in that direction. And so that's how you ought to measure the man you support or the woman you support next year.